Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Membership fees apply after free trial. Cancel any time.
Can I be real with you for a second? That goal you have to exercise and eat better? You really can do it, but nobody is going to do it for you. Nobody is going to push you out of bed to work out. Nobody is going to make you eat better. But here's the thing. Nobody has to. Because you can do it if you have the right tools and a community that cares about helping you get results. And that's us, Beachbody. 2.5 million people, each doing the Beachbody program that fits our own goals. Over 80 to choose from. Some that take just 20 minutes a day. Nutrition plans that teach you how to eat healthy and still enjoy food. What we all have in common is we know it's not easy. So we help each other. It's as convenient as your TV or laptop, but you need to decide that you're worth it. That's why I'm inviting you to try our amazing Beachbody fitness and nutrition programs. Let us help you succeed. Here's how. Go to Beachbody.com to claim your free membership and start feeling great.
You're listening to Unexplained. Season 5, Episode 18, Learning to See, Part 2. Peter Hercos arrived at TF Green Airport in Providence, Rhode Island, on Wednesday, January 29th, 1964, just after 8 p.m, accompanied by Jim Crane, a wealthy speculator who'd offered to provide security for Peter as a favor. Waiting for them at the airport was Massachusetts Assistant Attorney General John Bottomley and Detective Sergeant Leo Martin. With the authorities keen to avoid any unwanted press, Hercos and Crane were quickly whisked through arrivals and out into the bitterly cold night air toward a waiting vehicle. From there, they were taken to the Green Inn Motel in Lexington and checked in under false names. This would be their base for the next week, where the police could utilize Peter in secret, with Dr. Andrea Puharich also present throughout their time at the motel to supervise the proceedings. It was early the following morning when Detective Julian Soschnick from the Strangler Task Force arrived at Peter's room, carrying two large boxes and a stack of envelopes. Inside the boxes were a series of items that once belonged to the murdered women, and inside the envelopes, over 300 photographs of the various crime scenes. With Peter sitting opposite him, Soschnick removed each batch of photos from the envelopes one by one and placed them carefully face down in piles on the coffee table, as per Peter's instructions. Then, Peter leant forward and placed a finger on the back of one of the piles. "This is phony," he shouted suddenly, shooting up from the seat, pointing at Soschnick. "Why are you playing tricks?" Detective Soschnick shuffled uncomfortably in his seat, then got up and removed a photo from the pile. It was an image of an unrelated crime that he'd placed there as a test. as he tried to explain, he just wanted to see if Peter could be trusted. Grabbing the first photo from a pile, without looking at it, he held it up to the detective. "This is a dead woman, her legs far apart, like this," said Peter, theatrically throwing himself to the ground in a strange, exaggerated pose. The startled Sozhnik looked on in amazement. Herkos had positioned himself identically to the body in the image. After finally calming down, Peter began picking his way through the photographs, describing details of each murder as they apparently came to him, while Sozhnik captured it all with a tape recorder. Sometimes Peter would sit naturally, deep in concentration as he held the objects in his hands or studied another photograph. Other times, whenever he found it difficult to concentrate, or if he found the presence of the others in the room too distracting, he covered his eyes with washcloths and wrapped a towel around his head to block out the light. It was a condition of the Assistant Attorney General that members of the task force keep an eye on Peter the entire time, even when he was sleeping, just in case any crucial evidence cropped up, but also to make sure he wasn't messing them around. It was a few nights in, after another 18 hours spent working with the items, with little headway made that day, that an exhausted Peter decided to try something different. After preparing himself for bed, he opened one of the boxes of items and took out a blouse and a nightgown that had belonged to one of the victims, then took them into bed with him and promptly went to sleep. It was sometime around 2:40 a.m. that he began talking in his sleep. "Hello, Engenheiro, W2DK1, W2DK1, Sophia Morta, Sophia Morta." The others present looked about in confusion. An hour later, it started again. "I take the shoes off. Here is the body. I undress her. I go to the church. I do nothing wrong." The words tumbling from Peter's mouth in a strange, exaggerated, high-pitched voice. Then Peter's usual voice returned. "Kill that bastard," he shouted, as he went on to seemingly have a fight with someone in his sleep, who he later identified as the killer. Moments later, Peter announced that he was inside the man's residence in his dream, describing it as a junk pile, in which, oddly, there was a spring bed with no mattress on it. There was a diary there too, he said, that would reveal everything about the murderer's crimes. Then he mumbled something about how the women let the man in because he claimed to be selling shoes, and then he would grab them when they least expected it. It was just approaching 3:30 a.m. when Peter screamed suddenly, "Get out of my mind!" then shot up awake with a look of great torment on his face. Peter jumped quickly out of bed and lit a cigarette, appearing rattled by the experience. After pacing the room for a few minutes, he took a final drag, then stubbed out the cigarette and went back to sleep. The following morning, Peter attempted to describe the man he'd seen in his dream. "He is not too big, maybe 5'7" or 5'8", a high hairline with thin hair, a mark or spot on his left arm, and something wrong with his thumb. I heard an accent, not American, French, I think. He has something to do with the hospital. He is a homosexual and a misogynist. He takes their blood and washes his hands in it. He has blue-grey eyes and a sharp pointed nose, a big Adam's apple too. He has the energy of a 27-year-old but is more like 52. After he kills, he offers the women to God. They are clean in his eyes because he doesn't touch them after he's killed them. He has strange habits like washing his hands in the toilet and sleeping in his clothes. He practices extreme sexual things on himself. As for the bed with no mattress, sometimes he sleeps naked on it as a penance for his crimes. If he doesn't kill, he sleeps on the mattress, but if he kills, he takes it off. He takes the victim's shoes and keeps them in a basement, and sometimes he tries to sell them. Then Peter stopped and took a moment to think. "That is all I have," he said. About the same time, Soschnick had the recording of Peter talking in his sleep from the night before sent to Bottomley's office to see if anyone could decipher a meaning behind the term W2DK1 or find any relevance to the other words he'd spoken. Later that afternoon, he received a reply. They hadn't been able to find anything matching W2DK1, but they did find a listing for a small ham radio station operating out of New Jersey, using the call sign W2DK. Incredibly, it belonged to the cousin of Sophie Clark, one of the victims whose murder they were investigating. The language Peter had been speaking at the time was determined to be Portuguese, with the phrase Sophia Morta translating as Sophie Dead. This had been confusing at first, until it was later discovered that Sophie Clark's father was Portuguese. As well as the victims, Detective Soschnick also brought photos of potential suspects to Peter to see if he might have an opinion on them too. Peter discarded them all, telling Soschnick that none of them were the killer. Then, one afternoon, Peter was examining the crime scene photos once more when he looked up suddenly, as if struck by an epiphany, then demanded a map of Boston and an object belonging to one of the victims be brought to him. Soschnick hurriedly pulled out a cone from the box and handed it to him, along with a map of the city. Peter flipped it over, then quickly began tracing a line with the comb on the back of the map. "Here," he said, flipping the map back over, "here you find the killer." Peter was pointing at the Newton, Boston area, close to Boston College. Then another vision apparently came to him. "I see him dressed like a priest," he said. "He has a French accent, and he's a pervert." Then Peter bent his wrist in an offensive, homophobic gesture, implying again that the man was gay. Then he dropped down into an armchair and announced he was done for the day. The following morning, Detective Soschnick picked up Herkos and his chaperone Jim Crane from the Green Inn Motel and drove them into Boston to meet with Assistant DA John Bottomley. Bottomley was keen to meet with the man himself to go over again what he claimed to know. While Peter and Jim sat waiting outside Bottomley's office, Detective Sergeant Leo Martin approached them with a letter and asked Peter what he thought of it. Peter grabbed it from him and, without opening it, held it tightly in his hands. "By God," he said, "this is from the murderer." The letter was addressed to the nurse director of the Boston College School of Nursing, the headquarters of which was located in almost the exact spot that Peter had pointed out on the map of Boston only the day before, where he claimed the killer would be found. According to journalist Norma Lee Browning, who wrote about Peter's life in her 1971 book, The Psychic World of Peter Herkos, Peter never once looked at the letter. It read as follows. "Dear Madam, I have a difficulty. Perhaps you'll smile when you read about it, but I'm coming to you because I think you can help me. I'm a Boston College grad, and when I look at the years I've been out of school, I stroke my longish beard. I've tried selling off and on for quite some time, and I'm still in the selling field. My reason for writing now is to say I am a bachelor, and for some time I've wanted to meet a good Catholic nurse who might have graduated from nursing school about 1950. Even an undergrad about that time would be okay, one who is working near Boston. I've even had the idea of doing an article on this class, interviewing as many as possible to learn their opinions and experiences in training and in the field since graduation, then offering the article to a nursing publication. Perhaps while interviewing, I might see a nurse who might like me as much as I'd like her, and if so, we could begin a friendship that might lead to the altar. Chances may be, however, that very few nurses of the year 1950 are eligible, or might even consider me eligible. Okay, if there are such, maybe there is a better way to meet them than the way I have suggested here. I'd be glad to call at the office to see you about this, if you wish. At any rate, may I hear from you? If you'd like to, you could call Dr. Richard H. Wright of Beacon Street, Brookline. He's known me for many years. With every best wish, I am sincerely yours. The name of the man who wrote it has never been disclosed, though he is often referred to as Thomas P. O'Brien. The letter had arrived that morning, sent to the police by a concerned member of Boston College, who was struck by the writer's peculiar request. With Peter insisting it was written by the killer, John Bottomley called Dr. Richard Wright, whose name the pseudonymous Thomas O'Brien had given as a character reference, to find out more. Wright, who was surprised by the call, was also troubled by the letter. As he went on to explain, the so-called Thomas was a long-standing patient of his in his 50s, similar to the age of the man that Peter apparently identified in his sleep, who had a history of severe psychiatric illness. Things quickly escalated when, after looking back at their records, police discovered that a call had been made back in 1962, suggesting they look into Thomas as a possible person of interest in relation to the sexual assault and murder of Anna Slessers. Without wasting any more time, police soon procured an address for the man, who was found to be rooming at a boarding house not far from the Back Bay area of Boston, where Anna Slessers lived. At the first attempt, Detective Soschnick, joined by Detective Tommy Davis and Officer Stephen Delaney, knocked on the man's door, only for him to open it and then promptly close it again, telling them he didn't want to be disturbed. Though it was only the briefest of encounters, Soschnick couldn't help but be struck by how similar the man looked to what Peter had described, from his thinning hair right down to his large Adam's apple and sharp pointed nose. Now convinced more than ever that he might be their man, the Strangler Task Force needed to figure out a way to find some evidence before making a formal arrest. Although they could take him in for questioning, it would require something tangible to keep him in custody. Such a move would be risky, since if he failed to give them anything, if he was indeed the murderer, the man would soon be free to kill again. Thankfully, the state provided a loophole by granting the police the ability to have suspects committed to a psychiatric hospital for 10 days, provided a formal assessment had been made of them. With the man removed from his apartment, the police would be free to search it for as long as they needed, in order to find the evidence that Peter was convinced would be waiting for them inside. The following day, the three men returned to Thomas's apartment with a warrant to search the premises and a doctor to carry out the psychiatric assessment. Peter was also invited, but told to wait in the car until the coast was clear. This time, things went a little differently. Once again, Soschnick knocked on the man's door, this time brandishing a warrant to search the property and bracing himself for the inevitable resistance. Then the door opened. "I'm so glad you came," said Thomas suddenly, catching them all off guard. Then, without further ado, he pulled the door back wider and invited them all inside. The men stepped through into the tiny room, no more than 10 feet by 8, as the shy, nervous Thomas tried to make room for them. The place was littered with books and notepads, and piles of junk, just as Peter had seemingly foreseen. Soshnik couldn't keep his eyes off the wire bed with no mattress on top of it, but also the oddly deformed shape of the man's thumb, again, just as Peter had described. As the doctor proceeded to make a psychiatric assessment of Thomas, he quickly volunteered that he'd once tried to have himself committed to an asylum, giving the doctor all he needed to have him detained. Thomas was promptly removed and taken to the Massachusetts Mental Health Center for a minimum stay of 10 days. With the man removed, Peter was invited up to the room. Meanwhile, Detective Soshnik picked up one of the notebooks. It appeared to be a diary. "Always run from temptation," it said in bold capital letters. Then he scanned another page. "I get angry, so angry," it read. "Women sitting in doctors' offices exposing their legs, wearing tight-fitting dresses and highly scented erotic perfumes." Then Peter appeared at the door. Within seconds he was on his knees, frantically searching through the piles of books. "He put all the killings on paper. We will find it," he said to the bemused detectives. Then spotting something, he pulled out a book from a pile by the man's closet. "Here it is," he cried triumphantly.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Sign up today and start communicating in less than 48 hours. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. You can also log into your account anytime to send a message to your counselor. BetterHelp is not a crisis line, nor self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online with a broad range of expertise available. And with BetterHelp's commitment to facilitating great therapeutic matches, they make it especially easy and free to change counselors to help you find the right fit.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Unexplained listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/unexplained. That's betterhelp.com/unexplained. Join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. The book Peter picked out was a textbook on yoga, filled with diagrams to illustrate the various positions. The first half of the book displayed images of male figures, while the second half showed female figures, a significant number of which had been deliberately blotted out with ink. Peter counted them and found precisely 11 figures had been marked in that way. 11 for each of the 11 victims, he said. Meanwhile, Officer Delaney was examining the contents of a drawer when he found half a dozen ties and scarves knotted tightly together. In another set of drawers, they found a notebook brimming with sketches of what looked like apartment buildings and their interiors. In one sketch, a bathtub had been drawn with an X marked on top of it. Soshnik thought for a moment of 67-year-old Jane Sullivan, one of the 11 victims whose murders they were investigating. She had been found dead in her bath. Another drawing depicted a bedroom with an X marked on the bed at the base of the headboard, just like where the body of 19-year-old Mary Sullivan had been found. Soshnik was dumbfounded. Mostly, the diaries displayed the inner thoughts of a deeply unhappy and unsettled man who had likely struggled all his life with sexuality and who was doing, as he wrote, all that is humanly possible to master human nature. A section in one diary under the heading "Remarks Made to Me by Others" listed numerous insults such as, "You're a menace," "You're no good," "You're a goddamn liar," "You're a disgrace to Boston College," "You're a womanish man," "I'd rather see you dead drunk in the streets than see you as you are," When are you going to get married, hey? So you like that boy? As for the rest of it, the similarity of his body and facial characteristics to what Peter had described, the misogyny, ink blots and strange apartment diagrams were certainly more than a little hair-raising under the circumstances. All in all, it was arguably a smoking gun at least, but it wasn't the bullet. With the pseudonymous Thomas P. O'Brien undergoing his assessment at the mental health centre, police took the opportunity to question him over the next few days. The man was told he didn't have to answer the questions if he didn't want to, and was also offered a lawyer. However, since he didn't believe he had anything to hide, he declined the offer. Over three separate sessions, Detective Soschnick, Assistant DA Bottomley, and Peter, under the guise of being a doctor of psychiatry, each took it in turns to ask the questions. The man was sat, huddled over on the edge of his bed, looking anxious and scared when they entered his room. A hospital psychiatrist was also present to supervise. Soschnick asked first why he'd written the letter to the nurse director of the Boston College. Thomas replied that it was a desperate ploy, the last of many, to try and meet a Catholic woman. When pressed on his relationship with Dr. Wright, he explained that the doctor had once treated him for a persistent ear problem that he was suffering from, in contradiction to what Wright himself had said. The man also confirmed that he'd once spent time with French Trappist monks and had once been a shoe seller, as Peter had suggested. At which point, Peter saw his opportunity. "You lose a button once in a lady's apartment," he said, "when you went inside to sell shoes." Thomas looked confused. "No," he insisted, "he never sold door to door, and he'd never been inside an apartment under those circumstances." Peter then pressed him on why he'd recently been sacked from a job at a shoe store after only working for half the day. "It was because they excited you, wasn't it?" he said. "The female customers. You couldn't control yourself. That's why they fired you." But Thomas denied the accusation and insisted that he just wasn't cut out for the job. Then he changed the subject and began talking about how he'd become convinced that the police were following him. "Why?" they asked. But Thomas wasn't sure. Maybe, as he explained, it was because he once thought about approaching a woman in the street to introduce himself, but just as he got close to her, he turned away, realizing it might be strange for her. Perhaps a police officer had seen him do this, he said. Also, a man had once sat next to him on a bench and asked him forcefully if he was gay. He thought the man might have been a police officer trying to catch him out. Puzzled by this meandering answer, Soschnick turned the conversation to the yoga book and the peculiar sketches of apartments they'd found in his notebooks. "You don't have to worry anymore. We know everything. We've searched your room," said Soschnick. Thomas looked up confused. "The sketches," replied Soschnick, "the ink blots." But Thomas insisted they were nothing, just a legacy from the time he spent studying to be a commercial artist. The sketches, he said, were something he liked to do from time to time, part of a game he used to play with his brother, where they challenged each other to draw places they'd lived in from memory. And as for the ink blots, that was just something he did out of habit. He always covered the female form whenever he saw it. Soschnick and Bottomley glanced at each other, unconvinced by his explanation. Thinking it was time to move things up a notch, Soschnick reached inside an envelope, then pulled out a photograph and held it in front of Thomas. It was an image of the body of Mary Sullivan. Thomas turned away in disgust. "Don't be afraid. Don't you remember?" asked Soschnick. The more Thomas squirmed, refusing to look at it, the more Soschnick pressed him, demanding to know what Thomas knew about the woman in the picture. Thomas began to shake. Soschnick pulled out another photo, and then another, imploring Thomas to look. But each time he refused, repeating only that he didn't know anything about any of them. With little else to go on, Assistant Attorney General Bottomley drew the interview to a close. The next morning, with Peter's work finished, Detective Soschnick drove him back to the airport as Peter reiterated his absolute conviction that they had the man they were looking for. The following day, the story broke in the press that the Strangler Task Force had been consulting with a self-proclaimed psychic. The story was a huge embarrassment for the police, with particular scorn reserved for Attorney General Edward Brooke, who was publicly rebuked for sanctioning Peter's involvement. A few days later, Peter was arrested by the FBI for impersonating an FBI officer on a very flimsy charge that some saw as an effort to embarrass him and Edward Brooke, who was due to begin a campaign to run for re-election. After 10 days, the man known as Thomas P. O'Brien was kept in for another 35 days, after which he was given the opportunity to leave the Massachusetts Mental Health Center. Instead, he voluntarily committed himself to the institution and is thought to have remained there ever since. No further sexual assaults or murders related to the apparent individual, by then commonly referred to as the Boston Strangler, are thought to have occurred after this point in time. It was just over a year later, on March 6, 1965, that 31-year-old defense attorney Francis Lee Bailey arrived at Bridgewater State Hospital in southeastern Massachusetts to answer an unusual request. The hospital was a psychiatric facility, housing convicted criminals judged by the state to be criminally insane, as well as all those whose state-judged sanity had yet to be evaluated. Bailey was already making a name for himself after getting involved in the case of physician Sam Shepard, who in 1954 was found guilty of murdering his wife, Marilyn Rees. The case, which garnered huge media attention at the time, provided the inspiration for the TV show and later the film, The Fugitive. In 1963, after taking Shepard on as a client, Bailey filed the writ that took his appeal all the way to the Supreme Court, resulting in the retrial that eventually overturned his conviction. That morning in March 1965, however, Bailey was on a decidedly different mission. Another of his clients, George Nassar, who was currently under assessment at Bridgewater Hospital, had suggested he come and interview a fellow patient of his, who he believed had something big to tell the world. Despite Nassar being a suspected paranoid schizophrenic who'd recently been arrested for murder, Bailey couldn't help but be intrigued by the request. After arriving at the hospital and being led through the various security checkpoints, Bailey was eventually shown into a dimly lit room where he was greeted by a 33-year-old man measuring about 5'9" in height, with broad, muscular shoulders and a thick head of dark brown hair, combed back in a slick pompadour style. The man introduced himself as Albert DeSalvo, who, according to himself, was also the Boston Strangler. Over the next hour or so, DeSalvo proceeded to outline to Bailey, in minute detail, all the murders and sexual assaults he'd committed, as unemotionally as Bailey later put it, as if he were describing a trip to the supermarket. At the time, DeSalvo, who lived in Malden, 6 miles north of Boston, with his wife and 2 children, was awaiting trial after confessing to raping several women, as well as committing something in the region of 300 other sexual assaults and around 400 home break-ins. DeSalvo had a long history of committing sexual offences. In 1961, he was arrested for masquerading as a model agency rep who doorstepped women, telling them he'd come to measure them up for future photo shoots. When some of them believed him, He proceeded to take their measurements and sexually assault them in the process. After spending only 12 months in prison for the crime, being released 2 months before the first apparent Boston Strangler murder, DeSalvo was arrested again in November 1964, 10 months after the last, for his suspected involvement in the sexual assault of another woman who'd been left tied to her bed after being molested by a man who'd broken into her apartment. After being arrested, DeSalvo was picked out in a lineup by the woman. A few days later, a number of other women who'd been similarly attacked in Connecticut identified DeSalvo as their attacker too. A short time after that, DeSalvo confessed to the countless other crimes. In his confession to Francis Bailey, DeSalvo is said to have listed numerous details about the crime scenes that were yet to be made public. In spite of this, however, no physical evidence connecting him to the apparent Boston Strangler crimes was ever established. As a result, in 1967, with F. Lee Bailey, as he would come to be known, representing him, DeSalvo was only put on trial for the earlier offences he was already accused of. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. And although D.A. Edward Brooks and Boston police were keen to draw a line under the Strangler case, many remained unconvinced by the conviction. In a later interview about the incident, George Nasser, who had first alerted Francis Bailey to Albert DeSalvo, made a startling revelation. Though he claimed he was certain that DeSalvo was the strangler, according to Nasser, his confession was actually part of a bigger plan to get reward money for information leading to the strangler's arrest. He and DeSalvo assumed wrongly that they would receive $10,000 for each victim in return for the confession, which Nasser would claim and then secretly split with DeSalvo. DeSalvo apparently agreed to the deal because he knew he was already facing life in prison and wanted to make some money to send back to his family. Some have also claimed that DeSalvo's earlier confession to have committed hundreds of offences was also suspect, suggesting that DeSalvo was often prone to boasting and fantasised about being notorious. The fact that no physical evidence or eyewitnesses, of which there were said to be many, linked him to any of the crime scenes was also hugely controversial. And then there were the cigarettes. As author Susan Kelly pointed out in her book, The Boston Stranglers, The Public Conviction of Albert DeSalvo and the True Story of 11 Shocking Murders, 3 fresh Salem cigarette butts were found in an ashtray next to the bed that Mary Sullivan's body was discovered in. Neither Mary nor her roommates was said to have smoked this brand, while a Salem cigarette butt was also found floating in the toilet of apartment 4C at 315 Huntington Avenue, where Sophie Clark's body was found. Albert DeSalvo didn't smoke. Some also believe that George Nasser, a man considered highly intelligent and manipulative, may actually have been the strangler himself. In February 1967, Albert DeSalvo escaped from Bridgewater State Hospital in an apparent protest at conditions there, before eventually turning himself in. As a result, he was transferred to the Massachusetts Maximum Security Prison, known at the time as Walpole, where, not long after, he recanted his confession to being the Boston Strangler. 6 years later, in 1973, while at Walpole, DeSalvo was stabbed to death in an altercation with a fellow inmate. In the years since DeSalvo's confession to F. Lee Bailey, 2 other victims were added to the list of those thought to be murdered by the so-called strangler, taking the total number of suspected victims to 13. The first was 85-year-old Mary Mullen, who was found dead in her apartment in June 1962 from a suspected heart attack. Albert DeSalvo claimed in his confession that she had actually died after he broke into her apartment and tried to grab her. The next was 25-year-old Beverly Sammons, who was found stabbed to death at her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in May 1963. With the victims seemingly so unrelated, differing significantly by age and appearance, many have also questioned whether they were all murdered by the same individual. Peter Hercos certainly remained convinced that the man he had identified as the killer had been responsible for at least some of the crimes. Hercos would continue to offer his services to police and was invited to consult on many other cases, including the 1969 murders committed by members of the Manson family. He died of a heart attack in 1988 at the age of 77. In 2000, incredibly, so convinced were they that Albert DeSalvo's confession was not the full picture, both DeSalvo's relatives and those of Mary Sullivan, thought to be the last of the Strangler's victims, joined together in requesting that DeSalvo and Sullivan's bodies be exhumed for DNA testing. Attorney Elaine Whitfield Sharp, who represented both families in the case, also found a series of inconsistencies between DeSalvo's apparent confession and the facts of Sullivan's sexual assault and murder. After years of trying, in 2012, Mary Sullivan's remains were exhumed, from which the DNA, taken from the semen of an unknown male, was successfully extracted. The same DNA was also found on the blanket she'd been lying on at the time of her death. Without probable cause, however, DeSalvo's body could not be exhumed, so Boston police hatched a plan. After tailing a nephew of Albert DeSalvo's, they managed to confiscate a bottle he had drunk out of and had it sent for testing. His DNA was found to be a match for the DNA found on Mary Sullivan, suggesting that at the very least, he was related to her killer. Now in possession of the evidence they needed, in 2013, Boston Police Crime Lab dug up what remained of DeSalvo's body and extracted three teeth and a section of bone from his left arm. After examining his DNA, investigators found it to be a significant match for that found on Mary Sullivan. Odds that the DNA had come from anyone else were said to be 1 in 220 billion. If you enjoy Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now do so via Patreon. To receive access to ad-free episodes, just go to patreon.com/unexplainedpod to sign up. Or if you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, featuring 10 stories that have never before been covered on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Waterstones, among other bookstores. All elements of Unexplained, including the show's music, are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bizzle Fuma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.